Hello and welcome to episode 13 of the Fitness Mindset Podcast. My name is Kate Newdecker and today I've got someone really cool joining me on the show today. It's Will Girling and he is head nutritionist for Britain's first continental cycling team, One Pro Cycling. He's also cooked on Jamie Oliver's YouTube cooking channel. He's contributed to Men's Fitness and a host of other magazines. And he'll actually be embarking on a world record attempt next year, which is very exciting. So thank you very much, Will, for coming on to the show. And would you like to give a little bit of an introduction yourself to the listeners of what you're about?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for having me. It's pretty exciting to get to talk about some nutrition.
Absolutely.
So a bit more about me, I guess. I've been really lucky to work with, you know, an array of athletes from ultra endurance Ironman triathlon to the world level, and now also starting to work with people like Derek Chisora in boxing in the heavyweight world, and also tour around Europe and the world with One Pro Cycling in professional cycling scene, which is pretty incredible. And as you mentioned, I guess also my world record that I'm currently training for on my bike, which is another, I guess, different avenue and experience for myself from a personal point of view as well.
Absolutely, you're a busy guy. So it sounds like you've been on your travels a lot as well. What made you decide to want to break a world record? That's a pretty awesome feat. Did you just wake up one day and think, you know what I'll do today?
Yeah, it was definitely from a personal point of view. I wanted to challenge myself and see how far I could go in something. So from that aspect, this seemed logical for me, and I felt like it was something I could do because it feels a bit more mental challenge in that sense, where it's quite a few days to do it in a row. But as I started working in professional cycling, I came across more and more people telling me I was too big to ride, because obviously, you know, my background as well in training is strongman and powerlifting, so a lot of people were telling me I'm too big to ride a bicycle, which I thought was quite absurd. And obviously this happened more as I worked in professional cycling. And it suddenly made me realise that people stereotype you based upon how you look. Mm. And people are also so quick to judge and make a comment that could be very minor, but when that's repeated to you over and over, that can really set something in your mind against you achieving something that you want to do. And that could be related to, you know, gender, race, age, ability or disability. You know, I've worked with Invictus Games, with Team GB, and those guys that are obviously triple amputees or double amputees. And the amount of people that might say that they can't do a sport because of that now. And which is, once again, you know, shouldn't be determined by someone else. So I think it's, I guess, to raise awareness about stereotyping and how people can really change and do whatever they want if they really want to.
That's really, really interesting, because I think a lot of people, they put themselves in a box when it comes to their training. And some people say, oh, you know what, I can't run. Like, I haven't got the limbs for it. I haven't got the body structure for it. But with the right amount of training, with the specific work of type of training, anyone can do what they want, which is exactly what you're proving. So that's really, really cool. I didn't know that was the reason for doing it. I mean, I knew that you were doing strongman competitions before, and then all of a sudden I saw you cycling loads. But yeah. Would you say that your physicality has changed since your training has changed?
Oh, completely. Yeah. So I switched to cycling in November, wholeheartedly. To cycling in November 2017, and spent the last 88 months purely cycling, and my physique has changed drastically, and I've become, I have become a cyclist, you know, over this time. I've ridden over since November. I've ridden over 6,000 miles already on my bike, and done over 600 hours of training on it. So it's definitely become my life in that sense, and it's very different and strange to go from a sport that is, you know, maximal lifts for 10 seconds or under to me riding a bike and for 6, 8, 9, 10, 11 hours.
100%. Yeah, wherever I see you on Instagram, you're in a different country cycling through a different part. On your last trip, where were you cycling? What countries did you cover?
I was riding through Spain, just doing like a recce of my route for the record. So that was at the very bottom of Spain, in Tarifa, and then I cycled near enough up to Madrid, and then just kind of checking that out, making sure it's all good. There are a few roads that didn't exist that I'd plotted, so I had to kind of divert around those. So I'm glad I did it.
Is there any sort of things, unexpected things that come up on trips like that, like road diversions? I don't know, like what's the weirdest thing that's popped up on your travels?
I think things like minor things that you maybe don't think about, or how my saddlebags were packed quite a lot, so they swayed a lot on the bike, which kind of counterbalanced me a lot when I was riding. Avoiding, you know, when riding late, animals on the road and stuff like this. And obviously typical things like food, local food, and, you know, having that. I had a lady that I was staying with in an Airbnb say that the water was fine to drink and seemed so adamant about it. But then it obviously wasn't, because I wasn't okay afterwards.
Not so, okay.
So, I mean, there's loads of little errors like that, and, you know, it makes a difference, and it's all a learning process, really.
Yeah. But, so did you find that you were supporting your training with the local cuisine on your travels, or was it pre-planned?
No, it's definitely, it was all kind of what was available around me, really. So it's either petrol stations, or, I mean, in Spain in particular, there's lots of little bars with tapas food and things like this. So it's kind of just what was available and what I could get a lot of the time, which is really interesting when, as a nutritionist, you look at it. And I talk to a lot of people that do the transcontinental race, so the race across Europe. And you look at, like, nutritional strategies, and you can plan as much as you want, but when, you know, you're 16 days in and you've been riding 16-20 hours a day, you set 3 hours a night, like it's a bit of a different story, and you work with what you can, and you aim for what is ideal.
Absolutely.
But yeah, there's never going to be a perfect plan unless you're doing it supported, and if you do it supported, then obviously you're able to plan your nutrition appropriately and have everything for you.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's kind of seems a little bit silly to compare it to someone who isn't really traveling across a country. But for example, someone who does travel a lot, and they may think, oh, you know what, there's no way I can eat healthily when I'm on the road. But you can always try to choose the best option. You know, you can always, there's always a better option that you can choose, and just do your best. You know, there's no point going, oh well, you know what, there's nothing good here that's healthy, I might as well just eat a burger and a ton of chips and give up and a load of beer, because I'm sure you probably didn't actually do that. I don't know, you might have done that.
not that often, really. Like, sometimes I would have to have high calorie meals, but I mean, we spoke to you just before about pizza and something like that.
Yeah,
you know, it does kind of come into that category. But I think a real misconception is about, you know, driving long ways and then not being able to, you know, your food hasn't been prepared by yourself. You're in this petrol station and you're picking up essentially, you know, high calorie rubbish food.
Mm-hmm.
And like you're saying, because there's nothing, you know, invert commas, available. Mm-hmm. And well, you know, there's always going to be other options, but also you going hungry for another couple of hours is also not going to ruin your day. Like, you might feel hungry for a little bit longer, but if there is literally nothing else but horrendous, poor quality food that is maybe going to ruin your goals,
mm-hmm.
or not help you move towards them, then I'd probably wait another couple of hours.
Yeah.
Somewhere where there's something proper.
It's not going to kill you. And I do this. I have this rule where at airports, I don't buy the food because it's ridiculously overpriced and I can rarely get something that I actually want. So I just thought, you know what, I'll just have a rule where I just don't eat at airports. And it serves me quite well, because I end up saving money, and also I just eat something that's more nutritionally balanced and sticks to my goals later in the day, and it works for me. But yeah, like you say, you don't have to worry too much about having to eat every few hours. It's not binary like that. It's not the end of the world.
Definitely.
Yeah. So for someone who is, I mean, some people, you know, there's with a lot of races, they go, I want to do that. I want to do a marathon. I'm going to do it in 3 months. And they don't really give much thought towards their nutrition supporting their training. What advice would you give to someone who is going to embark on their first race, for example, so on their nutrition surrounding their training?
For a beginner, I guess the first thing I'd look at is the fact that they need to have more calories because they need to be aiding their recovery and performance from those training sessions. They need to be able to perform for the session and then recover from it. And especially marathon being a real common one and a real typical marathon style program tapers up quite drastically. It steadily builds and builds and builds and builds. And you know, in the last few weeks before they taper down for the marathon, they're doing a lot of miles on the road. And the calorie requirement for something like that to make sure they're recovering and they're not getting injured, because the amount of people that do get injured in the build-up for something like that is quite high. And nutrition definitely will help prevent that. And that's also looking at things like how much protein they're having, because protein requirement goes up for an athlete. And whether you deem yourself as an athlete, if you're going to train for a marathon, you're entering that world. You know, whether you're amateur or world level, it's near enough the same thing, because what you need to be doing to help yourself recover to perform, it is going to be along the same lines.
100%. And I think what I've seen a lot, and myself with clients, you might have seen it with clients as well, they do want to drop some fats before the marathon to aid with performance. But they struggle to do so initially because maybe they've had their calorie intake a little bit too low, which has affected performance. Do you find with people that sometimes you can get the calorie requirements right and then they start losing more fat than they would have done, for example, on a very low calorie diet?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's loads of different variables that come into fat loss and how you want to do it and go about it, as you probably know. But a simple thing can also be that we see loads of subconscious changes when people eat less. So when people diet or have a very low calorie diet, especially if they're exercising, what they're doing the rest of the time of the day, so looking at their NEAT or their non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which, you know, typically just uses step count, goes down drastically. So they go out for their hour, 2 hour, 3 hour run, whatever it is, but then their steps during the rest of the day are near enough zero. They do less activity, so they put less calories. So that's an immediate thing that we see. So they start to sit down more. And then some people also, because they're exercising more, they start to eat more. Because maybe, and that's why they're not losing that weight. And it will typically be maybe not the right ratio of food at the right time. That it'll probably be that they'll hold back for quite a while and then they'll feel really hungry and then they'll binge, which is, I think, a very typical pattern. You know, they want to be on a diet, really low calories, they're training hard, they're struggling, and then it kind of fall off that bandwagon and they binge, don't they? So, and have a massive overconsumption of calories.
I completely agree. And I think also with endurance training, sometimes it can be a bit more typical for those binges because you've got that huge calorie deficit at certain times of training, and then all of a sudden people find that they're absolutely ravenous. So I can see why that's quite common. I think as well, I've seen a sort of a growing trend of, particularly with ultra marathons, of people, for non-ethical reasons, I'd like to say, going vegan for ultra marathons. What would be your advice for someone who is seeing these things and they're thinking it might aid their performance in a marathon or ultra marathon?
Yeah, sure. So the controversial question comes. So I mean, if there's a lot of vegans out there for that reason, I guess they might question what I say. But I mean, there are currently There's nothing to suggest that a vegan diet over an omnivorous diet should outperform it from that point of view. Like, you can get everything you need from both diets if they're done correctly, and they'll both perform equally so if they're identical in the macronutrients they have and how they do it. So a vegan diet will not outperform an omnivorous diet just because it's vegan. And that's for sure. I think the biggest thing that maybe people don't realize when they turn vegan, whether it's for ethical reasons or not, moral and so on, is especially if you're doing endurance and ultra endurance, the significant difference you're going to have in micronutrient intake and the things that you're going to be missing as an athlete again. And running in particular, and the amount of impact it has and the effect it has on bone density, and the fact that maybe definitely a vegan will be having a significantly less amount of calcium, you see a huge increase in stress fractures in vegan runners. You also see 70% frequency of iron deficiency anemia in vegan ultra endurance athletes. 70% of the people that are out there are deficient in iron, which is going to have a massive impact on their performance, on their health, on their feeling of well-being. And I'm not saying that these things can't be achieved in a vegan diet at all, but I think a lot of people go into a vegan diet quite blasé, thinking that they can get by living a vegan lifestyle and not looking at the things that they really are going to have to maybe supplement or be aware of to create recipes or smoothies or something like this that are going to be able to incorporate those missing nutrients.
100%. I think the decision to make that lifestyle choice is often quite blasé, like you say, but the requirements for that lifestyle choice for you to be performing optimally aren't blasé. Like, there's a lot of work, there's a lot of education you've got to do to structure your nutrition in that way. So I think you said it perfectly in that, you know, performance wise there might not be benefits like people say. However, if you would like to adopt those lifestyles, whether it be for ethical reasons, moral reasons, then there is a large amount of education that has to go with it lifestyle changing to make sure that it is optimal for you. But I mean, there's incredible statistics, and I didn't know that people can get particularly injured, and and that's, you know, you could be out of a race, and that's the whole point, you know. So in terms of going back to someone who is embarking on a race, in race week, how would that nutrition differ to training?
So I think obviously you have different phases of your training period, and there will be other goals that come with those training periods. So a typical one would obviously be aesthetics or body composition. So if it is still to lose body fat, then they'll be in a deficit. Mm-hmm. Whereas in tapering week, typically their dieting should have finished and they should come up to a maintenance level of calories with a focus obviously on protein as well to ensure that they're recovering over that week. And in taper week, you typically see a lot less volume or total workload in that week. So they're doing a lot less. So the changes you need to make nutritionally should reflect that. And in terms of, I guess the main one would be obviously carbohydrate loading. And this would ultimately depend on how long the event is going to last for. If it's going to be less than 90 minutes, which would be more, you know, towards most people's marathons, well, everyone's marathon and triathlon and so on, then a typical carb load can be done in one day. So there's a guy called Busu who showed that you could do a same 3-day carb load in one day. Mm-hmm. And that was just through changing the GI or the glycemic index choices of carbohydrate, making all the choices as a high glycemic index. So this is actually more your simple base carbohydrate, white rice, white bread, things like this, over your steady slow release carbohydrate. That's because it stores more efficiently into the muscle. And then the amount that is recommended is about 10 grams per kilo of body weight. So quite a large amount for a normal individual. So obviously for myself, that's 1,000 grams of carbohydrate. And maybe not every individual, especially a beginner runner, might not need that. So edging more towards 6 to 8 grams per kilo body weight would probably be ideal. But once again, that should be something that should be practiced, and also depending on the duration of the event. I think if it starts to go up more towards 4+ hours, you probably want to edge more towards that 10 grams. Mm-hmm. I was just going to add to the end of that, that I think a lot of people would jump to me saying about high glycemic foods and...
I was about to say this, yeah.
Yeah. A lot of people would jump to being like, oh, how can you recommend white rice, white bread, things like this. And I think it's important that people understand that that is a single day that is focused on performance and not health. Your week and everything else you do on a general everyday basis is based on health. This is specifically for performance of ultra endurance events. And that's the differentiation. There needs to be that, because you can't carb load every day of your life, and you shouldn't be eating foods like that every day of your life. But this is a single day for a specific event.
And one of the main things that I keep seeing the fitness industry, you know, bang on about is the black and white mentality between things. Because one minute we are terrified of high GI foods, and then all of a sudden we said, no, they're actually fine, have them after training. That got awfully skewed, and that information got delivered in a way to people to say that actually there's no difference between high GI and low GI, just have it whatever way. But like you said, it's the performance reason it's better for you to actually spike insulin, and so therefore you can use the carbohydrate more readily and more quickly. However, for someone who may be wanting to lose weight in a normal lifestyle, maybe choosing those foods wouldn't be optimal for them, because they might find it might increase appetite. What do you think about that? Would you say that high GI foods, day-to-day life, would might change appetite levels for the average person?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting question, because I think nutrition in specific, more so than a lot of other areas, is so individualized. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's so much controversial talk within it. Mm-hmm. And it's always taking that person as an individual and their context. Obviously, you know, people with diabetes, whether type 1 or type 2, the person's goal, body composition related or maintenance, the event that they're training for, and so on. And also the degree of which they're trained. You look at a professional athlete and their ability to utilize simplified carbohydrate and store it is significantly more efficient than the said everyday person who just started training. So, I mean, that comes down to insulin sensitivity and also the regularity of using muscle glycogen or stored carbohydrates. So how you fit that for an everyday person, I would say, generally speaking, that I would probably opt for low GI carbohydrates, because one, yeah, they're more filling. They tend to come with more fiber and they are more slow releasing. Whereas typically, you look at high GI, there's less fiber and they're not going to fill you up for as long. And they will spike insulin, which can typically, if eaten on their own, so not in combination with fat or protein, which can alter GI, then they'll find themselves hungry and crashing possibly afterwards with that potential sugar low. But in terms of like high GI after training, I think that's worthwhile for a lot of people, especially even when they're dieting. And if it's understood why, I think this is why coaching is so important, is that if you are a healthy everyday person and you are training and you are dieting, it's a good way for them to incorporate foods that they still like in their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And I think this is really important. There's too many people thinking that, you know, I'm inverted commas dieting. I need to eat this way. And there is no reason why you incorporating some high GI carbohydrate in a period where it's going to be used effectively would, you know, help you manage your whole week and your lifestyle and not feel like you're denying yourself. But obviously, at the same time, it's important to understand that that's not also an excuse to binge. And it ultimately needs to reflect the goal, which is whatever it might relate to the person.
It's just taking it back to that end goal again. And I think, like you say, it's I personally, with certain clients, obviously everyone's individual, like to help adopt the 80-20% rule with these foods. So 80%, you've got your nutritious, high nutritious food, a high micronutrient dense food, and then 20% you've got that allowance for more fun food, going out on fun occasions. And I think that does allow for that balance, and also it kind of helps with the mindset between good and bad foods. There are no good or bad foods, it's just that there's different levels of micronutrients and different levels of energy and macronutrients as well. And but that comes down to education, and that comes down to people getting a little bit more knowledgeable about nutrition as well. So I mean, one of the ways to get a lot more knowledgeable about nutrition is to start cooking yourself. I say, you know, start making cooking recipes yourself. And you have a ton of fantastic recipes on your website and on various social media platforms. What made you start to get cooking, and what ignited that fire to get cooking? Because I think some people just hate cooking. I don't like cooking personally. So how do you sort of get excited about cooking?
Oh, it's a question I haven't thought about that much. I mean, how it started, I definitely know. And that was when I went traveling. I'd been a PT for 2 years, and I'd already started to find that nutrition was something that I really loved, but I hadn't become, you know, someone who cooks a lot still and, you know, adored it. And when I went traveling, obviously, you pretty much have to save money that you cook all your meals. And I ended up doing loads of big group meals where everyone chips in, you know, £5, and I'd be the guy that cooked it. And, you know, that's how it built, and, you know, doing curries and big, you know, big burgers and so on and so on. Yeah. And that was when traveling happened and my love for cooking. And I came back, you know, wanting to be a nutritionist and I think something that I realized is that people don't eat grams of protein and grams of carbohydrate and fat. What they eat are meals and food. And I think creating a diet or helping people pick meals that they enjoy is the difference between, you know, I guess succeeding in especially body composition, body fat related goals and not. Because you can have the same meal macronutrient wise and grams wise, you know, if, let's say chicken, sweet potato and rice is a real common one for bodybuilding, but you could be the person that literally just bakes your chicken breast and has plain sweet potato and plain rice. Or you could be the person that makes that interesting and you can have that more regularly because you want to, you know, slice your chicken breast down the middle and stuff it with olives and, you know, seasoning, and then also salsa in your rice because that's only tomatoes, coriander and lime and some spices, and that changes the whole dynamic of the meal just because you've added some zest and some flavor of how you've cooked it.
100%. Yeah, and I think it's one of those things that short term you just don't see the benefit because you're just like, oh, do you know what, I cannot be bothered. But long term, the benefits of that, of making your recipes more interesting, means that your diet's going to be way more sustainable. It's going to last way longer, and it's going to be enjoyable. It's going to be a lifestyle that you adopt, which means that it's going to work in the long term. And that's essentially what people want. They just don't realize the little components as to what gets you there in the long run.
Yeah,
so just,
I definitely want to come back quickly as well to where you said, where would a beginner start and how that relates to cooking and recipes. I think a big one is that maybe people don't invest enough time into it, and they want the answer but don't want to invest the time into it. And how many people, and I mean, I know from my experience, actually understand how many calories and what amounts of protein, fat and carbohydrate are in the foods that they have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a really useful tool for anyone, whether they want to do it long term or not, is to track their food. And whether you do it for 2 weeks, a month, or long term, like I said, it doesn't matter. But if you did 2 weeks of tracking all your food, you would suddenly have so much more insight into what you eat. You would understand that that food is high calorie, that food is low calorie, that food is high protein, and so on. And that can really inform your decision making about the meals you have. Because the amount of people that probably come to yourself and definitely to myself, and they don't even know what's in the food that they're having, like, generally. And I think if you're given a diet plan, like many of these things out there, like, I guess, the Joe Weeks plan, and all these things that they provide you with a meal plan,
yeah,
they will, you know, they will work if you follow them and you do the training. And that's evident in the results that they get. But you don't learn anything.
Yeah.
You have acutely achieved a goal. But then long term, you will revert to habits that you did before without any education on how you should be eating and how to manage that body composition you achieved.
I agree. And I was going to actually mention the Joe Wicks concept as well. I mean, obviously, there's a lot on social media about this as well, but it just lacked that education, basically. It lacked that accountability of what you're eating and the amounts. And yes, okay, it's cooking, it's fantastic. The recipe books are fantastic and they get people to do some more cooking. But like you say, tracking that as well is just going to be so much more educational for people. And just making yourself aware of what you're putting in your mouth during the day. Maybe you are having an extra biscuit, maybe you are snacking on things when you're cooking as well, and just being aware of those little things that do add up and may completely change the amount that you're eating, and then change that calorie deficit or maintenance surplus, whatever one you're trying to achieve. Then it's just being aware of that as well. So I think that's a really, really good point that you bring that up as well. So bring it back to your training, bring it back to your nutrition at the moment. Obviously, I think there is this huge fallacy with trainers, with athletes, because you are an athlete, essentially you are training towards something next year. And it would be that your nutrition is completely on point. It's completely perfect for every session, training session. What's your nutrition like at the moment?
Not completely perfect, by any means. I think definitely there is this belief that if you're a personal trainer or something like this, you don't drink, mm-hmm. you don't eat these foods. And then when people see you have them, they're like, oh, good gracious. I thought you were, you know, a nutritionist and all this kind of stuff. And I think everything in moderation, including moderation.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at that timeline of where your goal is and what you're doing, that also reflects where you are with your food, I think, as well. You know, I'm a year and 4 weeks away from my attempt. My training is still really hard. I mean, I rode 130 miles on Sunday,
wow.
which is 8 hours on the bike.
Insane.
Yeah, and you know, I did 8 hours on the bike, and halfway, a lot of people had fish and chips in Brighton. I didn't in the end, but I was still eating on the bike, you know.
Are you eating when you were actually on the bike?
I was eating on the bike, you know, and something like that. I'm eating every 20 minutes on the bike to make sure that I can still perform what I'm doing and focus that this is a training ride and I need to make sure that I'm able to keep doing what I'm aiming to do. But it comes back to that, what we mentioned about the timing of certain things, like those high GI carbohydrates. I definitely pick to choose the foods that I enjoy a lot in that post-workout period. I know how much I need to recover and what's optimal for myself. And I, you know, it being hot, I have a real soft spot for ice cream.
Yeah.
You know? And I definitely tuck that in there. But I also, I think after tracking my food for so long, and I've been tracking my food for about 8 years.
Yeah.
On and off, but obviously it being my job, and you probably know yourself as well, that you start to just know what's in food. Mm-hmm. And you just know, all right, that's going to be that many calories and it's going to have that much protein and so on and so on. And after a certain point, I know I still set myself macronutrient targets for certain training days. And I will then eat in relation to that. And I will say, though, it is always very much focused around my training. It will be, you know, that meal that I have before that session will directly impact the session I'm doing that day and what the aim of that session is. And I'll also, if I'm going to see friends and eating for a meal out, I will typically not have my post-workout carbohydrate, and I'll shift that back and have it in the evening so I can enjoy myself with friends. And I think that's a big one, is periodizing your nutrition and understanding where you can move things and where you can have more calories and less calories in relation to social engagements and the training load as well.
Yeah, it's kind of intuitive periodization. I don't know if that's a thing,
but yeah.
I'm sure it will be a thing. There will be a new thing in type of eating. But yeah, like you say, it comes with that education. It comes with that experience. It comes with thinking ahead. And I think if people can educate themselves, get a little bit more knowledge about nutrition, then they can start to think ahead about these things and then not be like, oh my God, I've got a social occasion and now I'm going to have to hold back at the social occasion, which then is not fun. It makes it unenjoyable. Then you can kind of, you can hold back before because you can preempt it in a way. So yeah. Cool. You've covered a lot today. If you could round up and you could give three tips for someone who is embarking on their changing their nutrition for the better, changing their lifestyle for the better, what could you give them? Just three actionable tips.
Are we going beyond the generic of eat more fruit and veg?
Anything. It can be mindset based. It can be nutrition, fitness. Anything you want.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it could be anything. Yeah. Well, I think what I've always suggested about people tracking for a period of time and understanding their food they have is something I completely stand by. And I think if you have no understanding of food, I would set the challenge to anyone to do 2 weeks or 3 weeks or four even of just tracking your food and just seeing what you're having and seeing how you view your food in a sense of just understanding it a bit more. So it would be that. Two more.
I put you on the spot here, Will.
How?
Sorry. How?
I think having a goal is always something that is worthwhile. If you are aimlessly training, you're gonna never be as motivated for something. You know, if you say you want to lose weight, you don't really understand how much you need to lose, what you want to lose, why you're truly wanting to lose it. And I think that why is also a really big one. And that I think that also comes down to, you know, the stereotypes that I've been talking about initially for what I'm trying to raise awareness about. And I think people, you look at the reason behind why you're doing something, and then that will really fuel your passion and what make you want to do more. As well. And a third one. I think you mentioned it earlier. Actually, I'm gonna take it a bit on the spur of the moment, and that was in relation to cookbooks and recipes. I think looking at cookbooks is a really good idea. I get a lot of ideas and a lot of imagination for the things that I make from cookbooks. And I don't even make a lot of the things in the cookbook. I go with flavors. Like, oh, here you go. My favorite book is Flavor Thesaurus.
Okay. What's that?
It's Flavor Thesaurus.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And it's literally a book about how flavors combine with each other.
That sounds really cool.
you can see what flavors mix with each other in the best way. And it does, it gives you some recipes, but I don't look at them. I just, you can just see what that flavor is going to go with that one really well. And I make meals based upon that.
That's so cool. That's a good sort of nugget of knowledge there for you, because I think I'll be investing in that as well to make my cooking a little bit more interesting, because I am so clueless. So I'll be getting that.
Yeah, definitely the best book I've read on cooking.
Cool. Will, thank you so much for coming on the show today. Would you like to just leave your Instagram handle, website, any other social media so that people can give you a follow and obviously get more recipes and more helpful advice from you?
Yeah, sure. So my Instagram is at Will Gerling, and it's the same for my website, willgerling.com, which you can go on there. And there's loads of recipes on there that they can look at, and I do the same on my Instagram. So if they want to check that out, it'd be great. And if they have any questions as well after this, they're more than welcome to drop me a message and I'll get back to them.
Of course. Will, thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll wrap it up there. And thank you so much for everyone for listening.